Well, we're in the book of Ecclesiastes this morning, Ecclesiastes, and we'll be in chapter 10, and we'll be looking at verses 12 through 20. This is number 19 in our series in Ecclesiastes, and we only have three more after this Sunday, after this sermon. We'll be looking at chapter 11 in one message, and then we'll look at chapter 12 in two different messages. Today, Ecclesiastes 10, 12 through 20, I love this book. I think it's particularly relevant for us, the wisdom that we find in this book, and I hope that you have enjoyed it, and I hope to enjoy a few more messages here with you in Ecclesiastes. And I was thinking about Ecclesiastes and thinking about the wisdom literature in general, and it's interesting to me. I think you've probably seen this proliferation over the last few years, and maybe we'll call it 10 years or so, where we're increasingly inundated with all these little tips and tricks for living life. Life hacks, as we call them, tech hacks of some sort, master classes, that's the new thing, right? A master class on this or that or the other. Somebody was telling me about that the other day, a master class. I'm like, okay. That to me means something in graduate school, but I don't know. Master classes, how-to videos, recipes, guides, and the like. We all want to know how to do things. We all like being able to do things. We all really kind of have this little bit of desire to be Renaissance people, to be able to kind of do a little bit of everything. The difference is, I think, we don't really want the Renaissance work ethic to actually learn how to do things. We want the YouTube version. You know, can you just give me this in bullet points? I really want to know how to do that, but I've got 3 minutes. So what do you got for me? And that's how we tend to live. And I think that has caught, and I think we take that to our spiritual lives as well. Can you just give me the hack so that I can get this Christianity thing right? And I've got 3 minutes. Go. And I think we kind of want to live that way. And so I think over the last, we'll say 20 years or so, maybe a little bit more even, we see this just proliferation of how-to sorts of teaching. You know, how to do this, how to do that. In sermons, we see it in books coming out, the how-to types of books and sermons. And I think it's because we want to know how to do it, and we want to know how to do it right. But people, we're craving answers, and I think what we're actually craving is wisdom, biblical wisdom. And to get biblical wisdom, it doesn't come from a three-minute video. It comes from a lifetime of loving and serving the Lord. It comes from day after day, year after year, week after week, Lord's Day after Lord's Day, being around the people of God and putting the Word of God into our hearts. It's a crock pot. It was mentioned earlier, crock pots. It's the second time crock pots have come up today. I don't know that that's happened before, but it's a slow cook. It takes a while. It's not a microwave to learn how to live wisely. We have a series of wisdom books in the Old Testament. We have the book of Ecclesiastes. We have the book of Proverbs. We have the book of Job. We have the Psalms, which all guide us in principles of wisdom. And it may be frustrating sometimes because we just want to go to the Bible and say, well, what should I do? Well, depends on what kind of person you are. Depends on the situation. What should I say? And I'll oftentimes give people a frustrating answer. It depends. It depends. What's the situation? What's the temperature of the room? What's the right thing to say? What's the right argument to make? Depends. Depends on what kind of person you're talking to. Depends on what kind of person you are. It depends on the nature and the context of your relationship. Biblical wisdom takes time. It's slow. But we just like to get the answers. I'm very guilty of this. Politics. Who should I vote for? Can somebody just tell me? And we just want to find a trusted source and say, can you just tell me which boxes to check? Because I really don't have time to read all that. I don't have time to research the candidates. I don't have time to put into this. Should I buy this product or not? Well, let me just go find a few reviews. Should I buy it or should I not? It takes time, though, to really understand what we're talking about. Living wisely in a fallen world is the same way. it just takes time. And a book like Ecclesiastes can help us with this. And I pray that it has already, and I pray that it's one of those books that once we finish it in a few weeks here, I pray that it will be one of those that you just come back to over and over and over again. Because I promise you, you're going to come back to this book, you're going to read it again, and you're going to see things that you didn't see the first time. It happens all the time. So let's read our text this morning, Ecclesiastes chapter 10, verses 12 through 20. And then we'll see what God's word has to say to us today. Ecclesiastes 10:12. The words of a wise man's mouth win him favor, but the lips of a fool consume him. The beginning of the words of his mouth is foolishness, and the end of his talk is evil madness. A fool multiplies words, though no man knows what is to be. And who can tell him what will be after him? The toil of a fool wearies him, for he does not know the way to the city. Woe to you, O land, when your king is a child and your princes feast in the morning. Happy are you, O land, when your king is the son of nobility and your princes feast at the proper time for strength and not for drunkenness. Through sloth, the roof sinks in, and through indolence, the house leaks. Bread is made for laughter and wine gladdens life, and money answers everything. Even in your thoughts, do not curse the king. Nor in your bedroom curse the rich, for a bird of the air will carry your voice, or some winged creature tell the matter. What in the world are these verses about? I look forward to jumping into it. Number one, words. I'm foregoing some advice I got in seminary, and that was to always avoid alliteration, and I'm giving into it today. Sometimes it happens. I don't always do that. Words, worries, work, and wisdom. Words first. You know, every teacher of wisdom eventually addresses what we say, the use of words. This is very typical wisdom that we get coming out. The words of a wise man's mouth win him favor, but the lips of the fool consume him. This is the contrast, and wisdom literature in the Bible continually draws this contrast. You can see it in places like Psalm 1, the wise man and the fool. You see it in Proverbs, the wise and the fool. And so this is very, very typical of wisdom literature. There are really two ways to live, and there's all sorts of shades in between that, but the two poles are the wise person and the foolish person. Very typical. There are places in Ecclesiastes that cause us to scratch our heads a little bit. This isn't actually one of those. It's pretty straightforward what's going on. I think this, though, raises the issue to another level, and it causes us to think about this idea of communication. What is communication? Communication's a blessing. Communication can be a problem as well. Any of us who are married know that communication can be an issue in marriage, in relationships, any of that. If you've ever been in a foreign country, you have learned the value of speaking the language, right? I remember one time, I may have told you about this before, but one time I was in Russia, and I was with a friend, and we were teaching at an event, and I forget the exact circumstances, but for whatever reason, we were being picked up by a local Russian man, and we were being driven across the city to the spot that we were going to be going, where we were going to meet the people that we were serving, and but they weren't with us that day. And I know hablo Russian, don't know a bit, and this guy did not speak English, and so we're playing charades with each other to try to figure out what we're doing and where we're going, and he knew where we were supposed to go, but there was a moment that we're both sitting in the back of this car, and we look at each other, and he's just like cutting all over the city, taking these little back roads down these alleys, and my friend looks over at me, he's like, he could be driving us anywhere right now. Like, we may never be heard from again. And we're talking openly in English because he can't understand what's going on. And it's funny, in those contexts, you find yourself, when people don't speak the language, you find yourself speaking more slowly. And it's like, now it's just taking me longer not to understand what you're saying. Like, that's, we did nothing by slowing down the words. It, like, not getting it. And we all do it, and it's just a funny thing when we find ourselves in those situations. Communication is a gift, and communication is something that the wise person, the wise man, thinks about how we communicate, why we communicate, and what we communicate. This person, the words of the wise man's mouth, it wins him favor, but the lips of the fool consume. The contrast is so clear. Another idea behind this is the wise man's words win him favor, or they are gracious, gracious communication, gracious speech. Reminds me of Colossians 4, where it speaks of the one whose speech is flavored with grace, as if it were salt. We speak in a way that communicates, that has a certain flavor to it. It's a benefit to those who hear, and it's a benefit to him. But the opposite is true as well. The lips of the fool consume him. And I think we can couple this down with verse 14 as well. A fool multiplies words, though no man knows what is to be. Fools keep talking and talking and talking, and they're being destroyed by their words. We've all been in that conversation where we can tell we're not saying the things that we should be saying, and what we're trying to say just isn't working, and we're trying to communicate something, and it's just not coming across well, and we know I should probably stop because this isn't going anywhere. But 9 times out of 10, what do? We keep trying to explain ourselves and restate and say it a different way, and we just watch, we're just digging, digging, digging. Number one rule, if you find yourself in a hole, stop digging, just stop. But the fool doesn't have that. The fool just keeps talking and talking and talking, and eventually they hang themselves with their own words. That's what's being talked about. His words consume him. He just talks too much. Just talks too much. Reminds me of a proverb. We learned this one in our home when my kids were very young. We all need it. It's not just for kids. It's this one. Proverbs 10:19, when words are many, transgression is not lacking, but whoever restrains his lips is prudent or wise. The truth of this is so simple. Talk less and you'll sin less. It's just true. Speak less. It would be good for you. It would be good for me. We should all commit this one to memory. Maybe put it on a sticky note on our car, or maybe on your screensaver. Less is better. Less is better. But the fool, he doesn't heed this advice. He just keeps talking and talking and talking. Then down in verse 15, the toil of the fool wearies him, for he does not know his way to the city. Now, what's going on with this? Doesn't know his way to the city. Why would that be significant? This is probably a stock saying, so just something that would have been said. A colloquialism is maybe what we would call it. I am completely fluent in Southern colloquialisms. I grew up in a house that spoke in colloquialisms. I don't do that so much myself. But if you are talking about the fog as thick as pea soup, I know exactly what you mean. Or madder than a wet hen, or until the cows come home. This was just kind of dinner table chat. This is how we did it in my home. I could go on, and many of you could as well. This was sort of a colloquialism of the day. He doesn't know his way to the city. Who is this guy? He doesn't even know his way to the city. So it's just, can you believe the ignorance of this person? And yet they keep talking. They're just speaking and speaking and speaking, but they don't know what they're actually talking about. There's so much to think about with our use of words. Why are the things that we say so important? I'll give you a few reasons. And for each one of these, what I want to do is I want to explore the idea that's here in our text, and then I want to broaden out and take a little bit broader biblical view of other places in the scriptures where these concepts are developed. So I want to broaden out now and just ask the question, why are our words so important? Part of the reason why our words are so important is because your words tell me what's in your heart. Think about that. The things that you say reveal what's in your heart. Matthew 12:34, Jesus said, out of the overflow of the heart, the mouth speaks. You say the things that you say because you think the things that you think, because you love the things that you love. It's in your heart, and that's why it came out. I love what Paul Tripp says when he's talking about marriage and relationships. When you have that moment where you blow up on someone, you shouldn't say, I'm sorry, I didn't mean that. He said what you should probably say is, I'm sorry I said that. I'm sorry that I told you what was actually on my mind. I'm sorry I told you what I was actually thinking, because that's probably more accurate. Out of the overflow of the heart, the mouth speaks. You say the things that you say because you think the things that you think, because you love the things that you love. It's all related. Words reveal our hearts. That's why our words are so important. That's why they matter. A heart of wisdom brings forward words that are gracious, while the fool brings forward words that in the end are worthless and they expose him as a fool. Next, Christians' communication isn't only about vocabulary. Ephesians 4 and verse 29, it says this. This is a verse that is another one maybe would be worth committing to memory. Ephesians 4, 29, it says this, "Let no corrupting talk come out of your mouths, but only such as is good for building up, as fits the occasion, that it may give grace to those who hear." Now, I think we focus a lot on the negative side of this sometimes, and what I mean by that is the "don't say this" sort of thing. So let no corrupting talk come out of your mouths. Don't speak in a way that's harsh and corrupt and evil and bad. But it's not that Christians just have a word bank of words that we don't use and anything else you want to say is fine. That's not the Christian standard for communication. No, it's not just negative. Don't major on that. But the second part, "but only such as is good for building up, as fits the occasion, that it may give grace to those who hear." You see what a gift communication is? You can actually be part of the mechanism by which God dispenses grace in his world through the words that you say to other human beings. Isn't that cool that we get to be a part of that? And so the standard for our communication, if you're just in casual conversation or in a sermon or something like this even, the standard isn't, I shouldn't say these words because they're bad words. The standard is, how can I use my words in a way that communicates God's grace to this other human being that's made in God's image? That's a standard of communication. It's a high standard, much, much higher standard than just a word bank of words that we can or can't say. Our words are important because they reveal our hearts. So it's not simply about a vocabulary, a box. So a few questions, just diagnostic questions, and you can think through these for your own application. Am I using my words to tear other people down? And just think through that, honestly. Do I use my words to tear other people down? Or, alternatively, do I use my words to give grace to others? Intentionally, am I speaking in a way that gives grace to others? A couple of other questions. Do I talk too much? Now, I'm not answering this for anybody else, but just ask yourself the question, is it possible that I say too many words? Is it possible that I'm not heeding the wisdom of Proverbs 10:19, restraining my lips? Do I talk too much? The opposite problem, do I talk enough? Do I speak for Christ when I have the opportunity? Do I speak grace to those who need it? When I see an opportunity to give grace with my words, do I take advantage of that? Or do I just stay quiet and stay in my little corner, my little hole? Words reveal our hearts. Our words aren't just about a particular set of vocabulary that we do or don't use. Our words are part of what God uses to give grace to other human beings. So words are important. Next, shifting gears a little bit, he talks about worries that people have, and particularly worries about bad rulers that end up in place. And these all have some threads of connection between them. There's a little bit of disconnect, perhaps, that you'll see, but these are all bound together through this principle of wisdom and words and work ethic and all of those things, and you'll see that come together down in just a moment. Verse 16, "Woe to you, O land, when your king is a child and your princes feast in the morning." And then the opposite in verse 17, "Happy are you, O land, when your king is a son of nobility and your princes feast at the proper time for strength and not for drunkenness." There's a woe pronounced. You're in a bad situation if this is your position, where your king is a child, he's immature, and your princes are out partying. You're in a good position when you have good rulers who know when to party and when not to party. That's the idea. If your king is a child, the point is not necessarily age, though that's related. You tend to grow in wisdom as you grow older, but that's not the only point. The point is that they are not ones who are mature. They're not making good, sound decisions. In verse 17, There is a time for a party. There's a time for a feast, but it must be at the appropriate time. And here's maybe a modern day, think through this with me. If you're rulers, if you're ruling class, if we could say that, if they're waking up in the morning, they're hitting the bars, and they're trashed before 9 a.m., you're just probably not going to have the best trade deals around. You're probably not going to pass the best legislation. You're probably going to find yourself in a bad position as a country. If you have bad leaders, the organization will follow. We care. We care deeply about our rulers. We care deeply about who it is that rules and governs. There's some people that say, well, Christians should just worry about the gospel and let the politics take care of itself. Jonathan Lehman, in his book, How the Nations Rage, which is, I recommend it, he interacts with this idea, and he says this. He says, yet saying governments don't matter is, ironically, a short-sighted claim. It's like saying that feeding my children doesn't matter, only sharing the gospel with them. Right. See how long that works. You have to have both. So it does matter, and we care deeply who governs us. Israel cared deeply who governed them, and we should as well. The point is, these rulers were not using their office for serving of the people. They were using it for self-indulgence. And so the contrast is drawn. So we see the contrast again, the wise and the foolish, good rulers, bad rulers. Let's draw some application for this, broadening out. So we're looking at the specific verses, and then let's broaden out and say, how should we as Christians respond to foolish leaders? What do you do if you find yourself in a position where you feel like you have leaders that are foolishly leading? Number one, I think we need to remember to pray for your leaders, even the ones you don't like. 1 Timothy 2:1-5, Paul instructs to pray for those who are in kings and those in high position of authority. He doesn't say pray for those who are in a position of authority and are of the same political persuasion that you are. That's not the command. Pray for those who are in positions of authority, and specifically pray for them that we may be able to lead peaceful, godly lives, dignified in every way. That's our prayer for our leaders. Another point. Remember that the government has actual authority that's ordained by God. We see that so clearly, Romans 13:1-2. God has ordained authority, and he's ordained government to wield the sword. They have actual authority. But I want to contrast that with this next point. They have actual authority, but remember, they don't have final authority. And this is important to remember. Actual authority, but not final authority. The government does not have final authority. I want to read John 19:11. I'll start with verse 10. Pilate said to him, this is the trial before Pilate. There was a six trials that Jesus endured, 3 that were Jewish, 3 that were Roman. This is in the midst of that. So Pilate said to him, to Jesus, you will not speak to me? Do you not know that I have authority to release you and authority to crucify you? Jesus, why don't you defend yourself? Don't you understand that I have authority? I have your life in my hands, and you won't speak to me? Jesus answered him, you would have no authority over me at all unless it had been given to you from above. Therefore, he who delivered me over to you has the greater sin. You see, government has actual authority, but it's only a derived authority because God has given that authority. I think it's an important perspective that we have to remember. Acts chapter 5 is another place where we see this principle. This is where a couple of the apostles had been arrested, and they were commanded not to speak of Christ anymore. They were beaten and said, we'll let you go, but you can't speak of Christ anymore. And they said, no deal. We have to obey God rather than man. We're going to speak for Christ. We're going to do it because you're not the final authority. So responding to foolish leaders, pray for them. Remember, government has actual authority, and remember, it's not the final authority. Next, let's switch gears again and talk about this idea of work in verse 18. Through sloth, the roof sinks in, and through indolence, the house leaks. Interesting verse. Some see it as disconnected from the previous verses. I think there could be a connection here, that there are those who, by their abdication of leadership, these rulers by their abdication, cause the country or the whatever organization they're leading to be in a bad spot. And that's likely part of what's going on here. Could be a hint of both personal and also in a corporate sense. When you neglect the things that you're supposed to do, things get worse. You ever notice that there's some situations in life that just don't fix themselves? Has anybody ever realized and understood that? Like the check engine light on the car. Like, why is that on? I don't know. I think it'll go off eventually. What's that sound that your car is making? I don't know, but I'm praying for it. That's probably not going to make it stop. Working on things in our houses, something is not right. We ignore it. Maybe those of us who have some sort of a trailer and you hear that bearing start to squeak a little bit, think, it'll be okay. And then you end up sitting in a Publix parking lot in the middle of the night, 75 miles from home, to get your bearing fixed. Hypothetically, that's happened to some that I've heard about. Lack of diligence. I didn't take care of it when I was supposed to take care of it. I knew that there was an issue. Tax man's going to find you. Housework, I'll get that stain out later. Well, you might not if you don't take care of it right away. My family favorite, rinsing the dishes. Just rinse the dishes. It just makes life exponentially easier later. We could go on and on, couldn't we? I teach a couple of worldview classes, and I just wonder sometimes with some of my students, what did you think was going to happen if you took multiple weeks and did not turn in an assignment? Did you think this situation was just going to go away? Like, it doesn't work that way. And so that's the point. Through sloth, the roof sinks in. You didn't take care of it. You didn't take care of it when you saw the problem. And now, and through indolence, the house leaks. This is what happens when you're not diligent in your work and you don't take care of things. Moving into verse 19, this is an interesting little verse. Bread is made for laughter, and wine gladdens life, and money answers everything. I want to give you an alternate translation of this that I think will help us see what's going on. So I read you the ESV. I preach from the ESV, which is the English Standard Version. I think many of you are using that as well. In the NIC commentary, there's a little bit of help here that I think, an alternate translation that I think is probably getting it right here. The NIC commentary says it this way: people prepare food for pleasure, and wine makes life joyful, but money pays for both. And so it's back to one of these sort of carpe diem passages, these seize the day passages that we find in Ecclesiastes. You're free to enjoy these common grace, good gifts that the Lord gives. In this situation, it's to enjoy your food, enjoy your drink, your wine, but you got to pay for it somehow. So you better go to work. And you better not be slothful, because you won't have these things at the end of the day. That's the point. So I think that's really the idea behind this verse. What can we learn about work? Broadening out our understanding a little bit, taking a whole Bible perspective in view. Just a few things that I want to share with you on this front. Number one, work is not part of the curse. I think many times we think this way. If Adam and Eve hadn't messed it all up, we could just have, hammocks and palm trees all of our lives, and it would be no big deal. But that's not actually the situation. We learn that they were put in the garden to work. They were there to work. Now, work gets exponentially harder after sin, but work was part of the deal all along. Part of what we'll see when we get into our heaven and hell study is that heaven is not a place of sitting idly on a cloud playing a harp. That's not the idea and not the concept. There's the idea of productivity and industry in the new heavens. So work is part of it. It's not a post-fall design. It's part of the original. Number two, Christians have a higher master, Colossians 3:23. We work for the Lord, not for men. Now, we have earthly masters, we have earthly authorities over us, but ultimately, our allegiance and the reason we do the things that we do is not just to make a widget or just to sell something. It's for the Lord, and it's a way to glorify the Lord. And number three, laziness is not godliness. 2 Thessalonians, Paul deals with this extensively in 2 Thessalonians verses 6 through 12. I want to read you just some excerpts from 2 Thessalonians 3, 6 through 12. He warns about the one who's idle or lazy. He says that we warn you, keep away from any brother who is walking in idleness. Stay away from the lazy person. And then he cites the example of Paul when he was with the church of Thessalonica. And he says, but with toil and labor, we worked night and day and we might not be a burden to any of you. So remember our example, be careful, stay away from these idle people. And then verse 10, he says, for even when we were with you, we would give you this command. If anyone is not willing to work, let him not eat. So if you're not willing to work, then you should not be given the goods of those who are working. That's the principle, the biblical principle. Idleness is a problem. And then lastly, he says, for we hear that some of you walk in idleness, not busy at work, but busy bodies. Now such persons we command and encourage in our Lord Jesus Christ to do their work quietly and to earn their own living. Get to work. Don't be lazy. Here's what had happened. They knew that Jesus was going to return, and some of them thought this was imminent. It was very soon. And so they said, cool, here's what we'll do. Let's just run up the credit card and don't pay our bills. Don't worry about tomorrow because Jesus is coming back, and he's just going to clean it all out anyways. It's all going to burn, so who cares how I live? And Paul says, no. That's not the hope of the second coming. You have hope in the second coming, and Jesus is coming back, but that's not an excuse to just go check out and live irresponsibly. No, in fact, it's exactly the opposite. Look at our example. You didn't learn that from us, did you? And he's recalling their minds back to how we worked, and I think this is exactly what we need to do. We work in a similar sort of way, with our hearts for the Lord, with a view that we are living in a temporary world, and the reward, true reward, is in eternity. Lastly, we see this idea of wisdom. Wisdom, and again, he circles back to the use of our words. Even in your thoughts, do not curse the king, nor in your bedroom, curse the rich. For a bird of the air will carry your voice, or some winged creature tell the matter. Anybody ever heard the expression, a little birdie told me so? It's actually where this comes from, most likely. A little birdie told me so. When we say a little birdie told me so, what we're saying is that I know something and somebody told it to me, but I don't want to tell you who told me that. That's the meaning of the expression. A little birdie told me so. This is what's going on. One of my favorite quotes, you're the master of the unspoken word. Once it is said, you are its slave. You cannot reel it back in. Modern day versions of that crack me up today. When you send the email to the wrong person or a text to the wrong person. We've all had horror stories with that, I'm sure. I remember when I came and visited the church, Adam Mercero met me here at the church just to show me around. And first I was by myself. Many of the kids were home. I just came over for a quick trip to meet Adam and a couple of the folks from the church. And I remember after I met with Adam, I sent a message that I was trying to send to my wife, but I actually sent it to Adam because we'd been texting back and forth about meeting. And I just remember this moment of terror, like, what did I just say about Adam to Adam? And I realized that it was pretty innocuous. It was nothing bad. I just met with Adam, going to go wander around the area for a little bit, and it was pretty good. But you have this moment of terror, like, oh gosh, what did I just do? And that's exactly what's going on here. So be careful what you say because people are listening. But this backs it up even a step further. Did you catch the progression? Even in your thoughts, don't curse the king. Nor in your bedroom, curse the rich. Even in your thoughts. Why shouldn't you even think it? Because you'll eventually say it. If your mind dwells on something long enough, it's going to come out in words. And then you got to worry about the little birdies that are listening that you didn't know were listening. So even in your thoughts, cut it off. Way back there. Words, worries, work, and wisdom. Let's be careful this week. Let's recommit ourselves to use our words in a way that gives grace to others. To use our words judiciously. Perhaps to talk less for some. Perhaps to talk more for others. But with a commitment to speak in a way that gives grace. Our worries. Let's commit them to the Lord. We know that there are some foolish rulers. We know that, and we know they've always been around. I pray that we would commit that to the Lord as well, that we would pray for those in positions of authority, as 1 Timothy 2 tells us. Work, whether you love what you do or not, I pray that you would do it as unto the Lord, as Colossians 3:23 says. And then I pray that we would be the type of people that speak with wisdom and that think wisely, that we would cut off those evil thoughts, those cursing thoughts, even before they're able to take root in our hearts and lives. Let me pray for us.